what, as a feminist, are you fighting for?
The continued recognition of the differences between men and women. Feminization of culture has been tried and has failed in many ways. The Industrial Revolution and various innovations and inventions, all designed by men, have sort of unintentionally rendered the world much more amenable to the strengths of women.
Nina Power is a philosopher and cultural critic whose fearless work explores the intersections of feminism, politics, and modern masculinity.
She challenges mainstream narratives with clarity, wit, and philosophical depth.
Everything is verbal, linguistic, emotional, relational. The idea that you can bring about a sort of utopia on Earth by pretending that natural differences don't exist, right? This is clearly not functional.
One of the problems in higher education is that on some level it used to be based around male-brained ways of thinking, and that when the universities are taken over by women, they start to turn the university into what they should be doing at their age, which is basically a giant creche.
We're in a situation now where people in institutions are sacrificing truth in the name of agreeability, or sacrificing truth in the name of social conformity. The policing, self-policing of universities is insane.
Mm.
I mean, the number of people I know who've been cancelled for being sex realists, for wanting to research HBD, it's just crazy.
We know who's doing these knife attacks, and we know what they're from. So that's what needs to be confronted, but of course it can't be because it's racist and illegal.
People going to prison for posting on social media, whilst people who've committed all kinds of other crimes are not punished at all or barely punished. The asymmetry is getting wildly out of hand. The open wound that is the rape gangs, you know, entire cities and towns that are completely divided. A very small number of people commit enormous amounts of the percentage of the crime. That includes violent crime. You know, why should the majority have to suffer because of some very small number of pathological people? Because you can't say, oh, well, everyone else is allowed an identity and a race and pride and a history and culture, but not you. You know what I mean? Because people are going to say, well, why not me?
Mm.
Why are you pretending that I don't have any of those things? Also, you can't say, no, you can't criticise this group, but you're allowed to mock white men. This kind of hierarchy of group privilege,
yeah,
is the direct consequence of that is people rediscovering their Englishness and ethno-nationalism.
Of course it is.
Of course it is.
What else are they going to do?
How else was this going to go?
Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. I have a very special guest for you today, and that is the rather controversial philosopher, Nina Power. We are going to talk about her sort of relatively nuanced kind of feminism, and that could be interesting. So, Nina, hello.
Hello.
Would you say you are a feminist?
In some ways, yes. I definitely owe something to the second wave, but I would say the more realist dimension of the second wave, which is the recognition of the reality of sexual difference and the differences between men and women, as well as their kind of complementarity.
Mm-hmm. So this whole idea that you have in aspects of contemporary feminism of toxic masculinity, There's something inherently bad about being male, sort of Andrea Dworkin-esque kind of idea that men are evil. You're not so sure about that.
No, I mean, I think this was never really what was going on in the second wave. I think it's a weird mischaracterization of the second wave that somehow has been kind of the stereotype and the cliche has been taken up into a real position, which has then been exploited by certain forces in the media and culture to demonize men, which is kind of I'm completely opposed to. And indeed, I saw that happening, that kind of whole blaming men, inherent kind of essentializing of men as kind of fundamentally ontologically negative or something like this. And it bears no relationship to the reality. Certainly the real relationships that women have with men, their fathers, their brothers, their husbands, their sons. And it's extremely divisive. And we have to ask why that narrative was being pushed and who benefited from it, I think.
So, yeah, well, who benefited from it? Because one wonders sometimes, is there still a need for a feminist movement? I mean, haven't women basically got everything they want and more?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, I think what needs defending is a kind of sex realism and the idea that there is sexual difference and that there are fundamental differences between men and women, and that these things are not concepts or words that people can simply apply to themselves, first and foremost. And that these differences are what makes us interesting, actually. and we shouldn't pathologize them. For example, the talking about energetic young men, for example, young boys are being kind of medicalized and treated as if they're abnormal or unusual for being kind of highly spirited, right? But this is just what young boys are like, if you see what I mean. You know, so I'm completely opposed to what gets sometimes called the longhouse, for example. I think the feminization of culture has been tried and has failed in many ways. I mean, it's not just the feminization of culture, it's also the kind of racialization, it's all the DEI stuff. It's the idea that you can bring about a sort of utopia on Earth by pretending that natural differences don't exist, right? This is clearly not functional and indeed extremely dangerous, apart from anything else.
So what would the feminization of culture actually entail? We have seen that, have we?
Well, I think, yeah, in general, I mean, I guess people would think about it in terms of things like safetyism, for example, caring about offence and feelings and everything becoming more virtualised. I mean, it's a complicated story about how this happens because, of course, this is also these are side effects of technological developments, which, to be fair to women, is not really our specialism. So there's a sense in which the Industrial Revolution and various innovations and inventions, all designed by men, have sort of perversely and perhaps unintentionally rendered the world, as particularly in the West and the world of work, much more amenable to the strengths of women. You know, we've gone in that direction. You know, everything is verbal, linguistic, emotional, relational, and so on.
I mean, you're obviously an academic.
I was
in Warwick. You were out in Middlesex and Roehampton. And isn't it one of the problems in higher education and is that on some level it used to be based around certain stereotypically, as Simon Baron Cohen might put it, male-brained mm-hmm. ways of thinking. It's about disinterested analysis. It's about the pursuit of truth above other dimensions, including emotion and offence. And that when the universities are taken over by women, not necessarily highly feminist women who may well have the minds of men, but more everyday women, then they start to turn the university into what they should be doing at their age, which is basically a giant creche.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's truth to that. I mean, I think there are bigger issues with the university sector, one of which is the massive overexpansion. I think the number of people who are actually capable of thinking and studying critically at higher education level, as we would hope it to be, is very small. It's less than 10%, certainly. It's certainly not 50%. Right. So you have the massive expansion of universities for people who are not actually intellectually able to deal with high learning, right? So you get the kind of takeover of midwits, you get people being offended by opposing ideas, you know, people who are not able to entertain conflicting viewpoints and think critically, as well as massive expansion of HR and DEI type stuff, all of which makes the university...
And is the expansion of HR a consequence of a tipping point of female representation in academia?
I think they're related, yes.
How are they related?
Well, I think, you know, you're basically making work for people. You know, we have so many jobs that are completely useless. People don't need to be doing them. And in fact, they're actually actively destructive of things like intelligence or exploration of difficult ideas. You know, they get in the way of people actually thinking and being curious, you know, because they have these sort of dumb ideological ideas about what people can and can't say and what they can and can't research. So I think universities should be given back to the very intelligent 5-7%. Some of those might be women, but I think it's always going to be a very small minority within that very small percentage, if you see what I mean. The ratio is probably something like 1 in 10 and 1 in 20. I think that works, right? And then you basically allow all of the hyper-intelligent autistic people to go and do their thing, right? And you leave them alone and you don't punish them for wrong think or whatever. And they should be protected for their research. You know, the amount of research has been shut down by deranged, stupid ideologues is insane at this point. And it is partly because of this expansion. So universities, I think, shouldn't be businesses. They should be paid for by the state and they should be highly selective in terms of who they take in. right? But they should be really, really, really small, and they should be protected from this kind of activism and ideology.
Yeah, ChatGPT is talking bollocks, because I completely agree with this. I did, by the way, chaps, I did ask ChatGPT in research for this interview what Nina and I would agree on and not agree on, and I was told we would broadly disagree on everything. But no, I concur because it's the thing is, if it's paid for by the state, as long as it's not corrupt. Also, I find it bizarre, and I have done since the Blair government came in. You don't pay to go to primary school. You don't pay to go to secondary school. If you do well enough in your GCSEs, like you this is how it used to be, you do A levels. And you don't pay to do A-levels. So shouldn't it follow that if you do well enough in your A-levels, you go to university? Mm-hmm. And if you do well enough in your degree, maybe you go on to be a postgraduate. That seems to me to be perfectly logical. But no, apparently, no, why should a dustman pay for an academic or whatever? I've never understood that at all.
Well, correct. And I was the last cohort, the last year in 1997, to have free education at university on the basis of my academic achievement and paid for by the local council, right? But then they abolished that the year after. But that totally transforms the relationship to the university. Like, you're there, it's a great honour to go to university. You know, you take it very seriously if someone else is paying for you and you've been highly selected to study a particular subject. You know what I mean? It's not, you're not buying a degree. The idea of being a consumer or a client is completely absent from that.
Even when, so I get the impression, I didn't want to ask you how old you were because you're a girl. So I put you into the Mormon Family Search website. And I found two Nina Powers, one born in 78 and one born in 82.
I
assumed you were 82.
No.
But it turns out you were 78. So, yeah, you're 2 years or three school years older than me. So, but when we went, it was £1,000 a year,
right,
which Mummy and Daddy paid that. And so there was still a sense in which you're a pupil and you're there to learn and you're absolutely not a customer. And even when you did have to pay tuition fees to go to university before World War II, because you were not an adult until you were 21, Mummy and Daddy paid the tuition fees. So you were just as they had paid your public school fees. So again, you had this, and there were a few people, Margaret Thatcher, Enoch Powell, whatever, that were from state school, and they'd get scholarships.
Yeah.
But that was how it worked. And yeah, and once you make, that's the worst thing to do is to make them into a customer. You're literally creating sort of sophistry.
Mm-hmm. Totally. No, and then you end up with people who have a little learning, which, as we know, is a very dangerous thing. You know, and they have a very sort of fixed ideological mindset. You know, all of this said, I also want people to have access to lifelong learning. You know, I think people wanting to understand history and philosophy and science and art and everything else is perfect. Like, that's a beautiful culture right there, right? But it shouldn't be at university level necessarily, right? We have adult education colleges. I do a lot of teaching online. There's a really interesting world out there of kind of para-academic, post-academic stuff going on. Do you see what I mean?
Yes. So
I'm not against people having access to knowledge, including some of the best learning. You know, lots of people I meet, Zoomers who are in their early 20s, who are basically autodidacts at this point, and they're insanely well read. Like, they have access to all the stuff, you know, literally the whole of human culture online, and they've kind of used syllabi, I should say, to teach themselves, you know.
Yes, I suppose I think you could argue that universities go through cycles.
Mm-hmm.
I call it the priestly cycle of university, where you start off with the sort of genius autistic types, and they establish the university, and it produces fascinating knowledge. This attracts the kind of midwit Adam Rutherford types, who are in it for the scum, who are in it for the prestige and whatever. A normal range intelligence is associated with social conformity.
Yeah,
and so they then put conforming to the idea of the current ideas and competitively doing so above the truth.
Yeah.
As then the university becomes ideological, it removes the genius types because they tend to be
weird.
Weird, and who are you going to give the job to, the genius type or the head girl, you know, with a multiple A stars.
Yeah.
And then the university becomes useless, and then it goes into decline, and then it has to reform.
Yeah.
And it goes starts all over again. But what you did have the last time this happened was lots of independent scholars like Thomas Edward, the Aberdeenshire shoemaker, who was a world expert on mollusks. And I suppose this could happen again.
I think it is happening. The problem comes less with arts and humanities, although artists do need patrons, and I strongly recommend rich people to support struggling artists. We need better art for the current culture and what will come. But it's a difficult when it comes to STEM, because you need money for labs and whatnot. I mean, it's one thing reading poetry and so on. Do you see what I mean? So and I think that function is increasingly being taken over by high-tech industry and so on. You know, there are ways in which people are basically not really seeing the need to go to university anymore, and they're often at very high end, you know, of things. But yeah, I mean, I want to return the university to the sort of slightly insane, brilliant people. That's who it's for. Otherwise, what are we producing? Conformity. As you say, I think about 80% of people in any regime are conformists, you know, and then maybe you have 10% at either end. Well, do they unite? I don't know. But you have people who are resisting, and then you have people who are kind of really enforcing the conformity, if you see what I mean.
Yes,
you have
the uber conformists.
Yes, you have kind of sadistic psychopaths, many of whom I've unfortunately encountered, who really want to use the regime ideology to punish people for their own enjoyment. And many institutions, as we know, have been taken over by narcissists and psychopaths because they've become so weak. They can't defend their own values. They can't defend freedom of expression. They can't defend research that tells us things that we might not want to know, if you see what I mean. Know, we should be the really small number of very intelligent people are able to deal with information and knowledge and truths which are very unpalatable, perhaps, to the vast majority of people, particularly in a liberal regime where we've got all these fantasies about equality and universality and so on, none of which are true.
Well, no. I mean, that gets us back to this feminism thing in some ways. The idea that you can be equal but different seems to be nonsense. Women are evolved on average with modally different brains from men. And in academia, you're gonna get more male geniuses than female.
Correct,
geniuses.
But you are going to get a very small number of women. And as history shows us, in religious thought, in philosophy, in art, you know, there are some fantastic, brilliant women also in STEM. But they're a very, very small minority, you know.
No, it's if you completely abolish the ability to have women at universities, then you cut out people like, I don't know, Rosalind Franklin,
right?
Who was by all accounts autistic as.
Indeed, right? So we wouldn't want to do that, I think. We wouldn't want to return it to a monk like, you know, the university's originally religious places, you know. I mean, we wouldn't, I think, want to return to kind of all male. We might want all male spaces elsewhere, sorry. Do you see what I mean? We might want single-sex spaces in lots of different places.
Well, education, apparently, in secondary education, single-sex schools, at least for boys, do tend to achieve better results.
And for girls, yeah.
Yeah.
Correct.
So because they're not busy worrying about how they're perceived by the opposite sex. The learning can be catered towards the way they learn.
Absolutely. No, I think that's been shown. I mean, I look back at my comprehensive school education in Wiltshire. It wasn't a particularly bad school or anything, but I think about the amount of time we wasted on abject social nonsense, you know, because you've put sort of teenagers together in a mixed sex way. You know, it does. It's completely distracting. You know, even if you're quite a studious person and you're not particularly interested in the opposite sex, it doesn't work, I think. It's you're putting young men and women together way too much, you know, for no good reason, if you sort of mean. It gets in the way of learning, if indeed that's what we want to do. And I want there to be better mechanisms for identifying particularly working class people with aptitude and, you know, in high intelligence, so that we don't fail those people and we don't, you know, squander that sort of intellectual resource, if you see what I mean. You know, and that was ostensibly what something like the 11 plus was supposed to do. It had lots of other functions as well, but do you know what I mean?
Yes, and it may have been too early. There's evidence that maybe 14 would have been a better age to take such a thing. But something like that, which because at the moment social movement has essentially stagnated. There's very little of it. If you go back to the 50s and the Angry Young Men and that time, there was a substantial social movement because they brought in things like the 11 plus, free higher education at the point of delivery, and that sort of thing, then you could get these people that could move up, and indeed even people that didn't go to university, like Colin Wilson, who were able to get somewhere. Whereas now, can we think of that many people that are intellectuals that are from working class backgrounds?
Well, I think they do exist, but I think those traditions of working class autodidacticisms have largely been crushed, and we also have a very stupid culture, which is sort of very distracting and, you know, kind of very dominant. But I think that there are intelligent people from all classes, and indeed lots of very posh people are not very clever. You know what I mean? It's intelligence seems to be complex in that way. There's clearly it's clearly heritable, but I don't think it's there is a kind of randomness as well, if you see what I mean. Sometimes you get very intelligent people from not very intelligent backgrounds.
Yes, yes, yes. It's rare, but it does. It certainly does happen. Mm. And those people tend to be late developers because their intelligence is supposed to be being retarded by their background. Mm. And as they get older, they will start to create a background that's consistent with their own innate intelligence, or an environment that's consistent with their own innate intelligence, and then it will rise. Mm-hmm. Of course, the opposite can happen as well. Mm-hmm. That's true. So, I mean, basically, when you think about higher education, most of what it seems to be producing now, this vast amount of stuff is published. There's so many academic journals. There's so many books being published. And the vast majority of it is basically just getting something that someone else has written and adding something on the end. Well, I mean, that's research,
I was. I was thinking about the other day, it's like in prison, you know, when you get prisoners to make wicker baskets and then the warden undoes them at the end of the day and gets them to do them again the next day. Just make work, you know, just something to do. It's not even productive. Do you see what I mean? Mm. Right. It's just something to distract people. And I think this is what's happening at scale. None of this stuff is relevant or useful. It's just work for the sake of work. And I think one of the interesting, provocative things about AI, although I'm very critical of AI, is that it will actually eliminate the need for lots of midwit. I mean, these people are basically human AIs at this point. You know, they're regurgitating ideas and concepts just in a slightly different order.
Well, they're just doing things that are useless.
Well, yeah.
I was at an anthropology conference in Helsinki many, many years ago, and there was this girl, she's a lovely girl, but she was a lovely wee pretty girl, but she was doing cultural anthropology has basically become things which quite intelligent girls like, and they get funding to write about them. Mm-hmm. And on that basis, they get a PhD. I mean, she liked, what was it, somewhere in Sicily, some town. So she hung around the marketplace there and talked to the people that worked on the market, and from this produced a PhD. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, well, what's the point? What? I'm not saying there aren't any interesting anthropology PhDs, but another one was, no one's written anything about braais, which is South African barbecues. So I'm going to go to lots of South African barbecues and talk to people and then connect that somehow to a theory. I was like, what, you got funding from this? Mm. From the British Academy? From the HRB? Just no. This is completely pointless knowledge.
I mean, optimistically, many of the great philosophers were never in the academy, if you see what I mean. Mm. There are people are now as well, I think, outside of these institutions. And in fact, they would be stymied by them, if you see what I mean. Although it is difficult to have enough time if you're working to think for yourself in this way. But I think we're in a situation now where people in institutions are sacrificing truth in the name of agreeability, or sacrificing truth in the name of social conformity. And the policing, self-policing of universities is insane. Mm. I mean, the number of people I know who've been cancelled for being sex realists, for wanting to research HBD, it's just crazy. You know, anyone who wants to look at what's actually real or true, however unpalatable it might be, is a target. You know, this is anti-intellectualism of the highest order. I mean, this is the politicization of truth. It's the politicization of knowledge.
I was told the other day by quite a prominent journalist who I know that they were going to do an article in their quite prominent magazine on some stuff I've done, a book I've got coming out. And he rang me up to say, Ed, basically, look, you know, I like you, we're friends. I am going to have to slag you off a bit. And I was like, it's okay, I don't mind. And he was really guilty about this. Mm. And he was, we're a mainstream conservative magazine. And some of your ideas, frankly, are a bit barking, saying that there's race differences in penis size. I said, hang on a minute. No, I never published a paper saying that. Race differences in testicle size, yes. but We don't have the data on penises. But I think if we do have the data on it, we should publish it.
No, sure.
And that a lot of people would say that this is just, how can you say this? How can you stop? I'm not saying it. The data is saying it.
No, for sure. And I think human curiosity is a natural and wonderful feature of who we are. I mean, what are we supposed to do? Just repeat the same thing that's untrue because some idiot thinks that that's what we should say over and over again? I mean, that's like, you know, it's sort of tyranny, ideological tyranny, right? Clearly.
It's a complete inability as well on the part of these people to put logic and reason above emotion.
Yeah.
I was at this art conference the other day, and I forget how we got onto the issue, but I explained that there's at least two studies that have found that approximately 65% of women have rape fantasies.
Mm-hmm.
And this girl who worked for the Telegraph or something was obviously quite intelligent. She said, how could you say that? That's disgusting. That's a disgusting thing to say. How could you say that?
Mm.
And I said, well, it's not me saying that. It's not my opinion. What are you talking about? And she was just horrified.
Yeah. I mean, but the question from that sort of survey or study, the next question would be, well, why might that be the case, right? Mm. Why might 65% of women, if that's true, have these kind of fantasies? Well, we can start to come up with a hypothesis.
Mm.
Right? Maybe it's the kind of eroticization of sexual difference in the sense that, you know, if you're a heterosexual woman, you're in a relationship with a man, but on some level, you know that this person is stronger than you and they could kill you. You see what I mean?
So it would make sense that the women that got aroused by this would have survived in prehistory.
Well, yeah. And all the, you know, like the part of the kind of tacit agreement is to do with the acknowledgement or the reality of that difference, right? The difference in physical strength, you know. So in order to sort of cope with it, you can sort of, you might be able to hypothesize and say, well, okay, but if you eroticize that difference, because that sort of strength differential is also about being protected yourself, right? So you might be thinking as a woman, oh, well, OK, if we're attacked, he's going to try and protect me. But in order for that to be true, he needs to be stronger than me or something like that. You know what I mean? You could start to come up with all kinds of hypotheses.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's an interesting thing to do. That's what we should do.
Exactly.
But what the dominance of higher education by women, and they are dominant, and there's good reasons why they're dominant. They're dominant. They're slightly less intelligent, but not very much less intelligent. And they are more pro-social. They are more agreeable. They are more conscientious. They are more neurotic. And there's a degree to which neuroticism predicts doing well in higher education within certain boundaries. And so they just take over. You just end up with these nonsense people producing nonsense research that are highly socially conformist. And if the in thing is to talk about toxic masculinity, then they'll just say to themselves, oh, well, I should get toxic masculinity and add a bit on the end.
Yeah.
Well, no one's looked at toxic masculinity among nursery school pupils.
Sure, exactly. And when you read these texts, I think this is the AI aspect. It's like you can tell when people have shoved in ideological concepts because they ring really hollow. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
And you can just easily look at texts, skim these sorts of academic productions and say, oh, you know, okay. You know exactly what they're doing. They're just kind of shoring up this language because it's a kind of currency within the academy. It's like how you get ahead.
That's nothing. Language. Now, when I applied to do my PhD, well, originally I applied to do it as a master's degree by research, and it was upgraded to a PhD. And my undergraduate supervisor said to me, yes, very good application. Yeah, it was very clear what I wanted to do for my topic. And he suggested that you should use more higher order language.
Mm-hmm.
Redo it, but basically make it less clear. So redo it, but with lots of French origin words.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you have this internal sociolect among academics, which is that outsiders can't understand it. And you signal your social conformity and your intelligence, I suppose, that you can use big words. You don't say exclude, you say elide. You know, there's all kinds of these words that nobody uses. You know, you don't say crossover, you say imbricate. Or whatever, and then I think is particularly stupid. And in the social sciences, you get extreme examples of this. And when you bother to penetrate through the language, they're really saying something very simple.
Yeah.
Now, before we continue, I'd like to do something rather exciting. I know that you Generation Z people, you want to have read all of the based books, you want to have imbibed all of the most radical and important scientific knowledge, but you don't particularly like reading very much. So what if there was an app that would take those books, summarise them for you, and then read them back to you in less than 25 minutes. Well, fortunately, such an app exists, and that app is called Legiant.com. They have, for example, my book, The Past is a Future Country, The Coming Conservative Demographic Revolution, by myself and my friend Ollie Rayner Hills, in which we look at the way that there is clearly going to be a shift based on breeding patterns among the more intelligent back towards us being right-wing, and the return, therefore, of a kind of genetically right-wing society, a kind of neo-Byzantium. And here it is, The Past of the Future Country. And so you don't even have to read the book if you don't want to. This can inject it straight from the phone into your brain box. And if you sign up today with the code TJH, then of course you can get a 10% discount. So Legion.com, sign up now. All the base knowledge from your phone, direct to your brain.
I mean, at this point, I think most universities should go to the wall and the few remaining should be, you know, for the genuine intellectual elite. And I, you know, this is a very different from the position I used to have, for sure, which I wanted everyone to have free access to university education if they wanted it.
But if that happens, everybody, then it changes the culture, as you said earlier, it changes the culture of the university down to not necessarily the stupidest person, but to the average there. And
correct.
The average is now lower, less intelligent, less autistic.
Well, and this was happening when I was at university. I left in 2018. The more people were becoming clients and the more universities were basically telling students, often international students, because they could bilk them for more money, that they were basically buying a degree, the less we were able to critically judge students, if you see what I mean. Mm. Because the university was saying, well, you've got to give them a 40% pass mark. You can't fail anyone because we need their money. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So you know, the role of the lecturer then becomes... I don't know, like a factory tick box checker, you know, for a product, which is the student buying the degree or something like this. You know, you're no longer in a kind of critical intellectual relationship with each other or students or anything like that. You know, and that was a massive transformation in my own lifetime, you know, between the late 90s and whatever, mid-2000s.
You can't fail people.
Exactly.
Which is the degree is inherently meaningless if
indeed.
Everybody can do it. I suppose you could argue that if you're intelligent enough to be able to get in, you should be intelligent enough to be able to pass it.
Mm-hmm.
But there will be lazy people who won't.
Yeah, and then you end up with grade inflation, you end up with, you know, also students treating themselves as customers and clients and complaining when they don't get the grades that they want.
Or worse still, because of the infantilization process
yeah.
that we've seen. A chap that I do a podcast with called Dr. Paul Taylor, who used to be a lecturer in literature or something at the University of Leeds. And he got to a point where his student's mum
mm-mm.
is ringing him up and saying, you know, this, that and the other about the essay or whatever. He's like, madam, I am not in a relationship with you.
Yeah.
I am in a relationship with your son. If your son wants to talk to me about this, your son can do so. Why on earth are you ringing me?
Mm-hmm.
This is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was disciplined. He was given a warning or whatever. I think I'm right in saying something. He's told off anyway by HR for supposedly being rude to this person's mother. And this was it was outrageous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, this is the general sort of shift in things.
Parents are coming with their children to university open day.
Yeah.
That never happened.
No, I agree.
You went on your own.
No, and also we wanted to become adults.
Yeah.
You know, we were desperate to become adults. I was desperate to leave home and study and, you know, have access to the university library and, you know, interesting intellectual and cultural life with other adults.
Yeah.
You know.
And now they're desperate to remain children.
Mm-hmm.
They're not even learning to drive.
Yeah.
They're not. You don't drive, do you?
I've tried. I basically informally banned from driving, but that's another story.
What, you informally banned?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. But no, I can't drive. I
didn't learn to drive till I was 41.
Okay.
I tried to when I was 17. Had various traumatic experiences.
Yeah.
And then just thought, no, I'm not doing this. And then finally at 40, it's just do an automatic.
So, look, some people probably just shouldn't drive, and that's okay. Let's put it that way.
Did you kill a man?
No, of course not. I wouldn't be laughing if that was the case, would I?
Did you run into an elderly lady with heavy shopping?
No, nothing like that. Nothing like that.
Did you squish a cat?
No. I did have a terrible crash when I was 18, and I was about to be charged with driving without due care and attention. But they dropped the charge because they messed up the arrest. And anyway, it's complicated, but it's not that complicated. But anyway, it was just better for everybody that some people, like myself, should not be in control of a moving metal vehicle.
All right.
And that's okay.
Okay. Well,
but I agree with you in general. Like people, that these markers of maturity, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're having sex later.
Mm-hmm.
You ever had sex?
Unfortunately.
Okay, well, but they are doing that later, they have menu anxiety. Do you have menu anxiety?
No,
neither do I. You know, but they need to see the menu online beforehand and decide what they want.
Sure, but how do we have a reinvigorated culture then? Like, what needs to happen for young people to become adults, to become parents?
Bring it back to the. I can only assume that. The things that we saw when we were younger and the generation in charge had fought and won a war, which I think is important, that kind of harshness which existed needs to come back. And there needs to be an op. Maybe you could say if you go back too far, it's too harsh and too awful and traumatizing. But there needs to be more that life was more real. I wonder if, in part, because of the war,
mm-hmm.
or just if it's just more general. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I was listening to Louise Perry's interview with David Betts recently. I don't know if you heard this on the Civil War, right? The possibility of civil war in Britain, and he was very, blackpilled about it. Let's say, insofar as he thought it was a genuinely real possibility.
But is it a bad thing?
Well, I mean, I prefer there not to get to the point where people are sort of actively, violently encountering each other on the streets. But I think we should be paying attention to what are the pressure points. And, you know, I'm very, very opposed to people going to prison for posting on social media, for example, whilst people who've committed all kinds of other crimes are not punished at all or barely punished. You know, I mean, the asymmetry is getting wildly out of hand. You have an insanely out of touch government who's saying, oh, we need to stop knives being sold on Amazon or round the tips or something. I mean, this is like, you know, corrupt, deranged, out of touch government beyond belief, right? Mm. This is nothing to do with reality. The open wound that is the rape gangs, you know, entire cities and towns that are completely divided. I mean, it's not good.
There's a number of papers that have argued that the reason why violence was heavily reduced across time between the medieval era and more recently, or indeed across the period of the Roman Empire or the Republic,
mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a kind of a process of the taming of the gene. Basically, every felony was punishable by death.
Mm-hmm.
Every generation, about 2% of the male population, young, childless male population, were hanged.
Yeah, I heard this.
With the consequence that the genes for violence were suppressed. So there's a strong genetic component of violence. And so it's quite clear that we know who's doing these knife attacks, and we know what they're from, and we know that. So that's what needs to be confronted. But of course, it can't be because it's way system are all equal.
Yeah, I mean, you have current examples like Bukele in El Salvador, you know, locking up probably 1% of the population or something like that.
Crime rates collapse.
Homicide has gone down, you know, it almost sounds like a holiday destination at this point, right? When it was previously one of the most violent countries in the world. It does seem obvious, again, it's a sort of truth, that a very small number of people commit enormous amounts of the percentage of the crime, and that includes violent crime. You know, and why should the majority have to suffer because of some very small number of pathological people? I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
That's what they argued in the medieval church, because,
right.
Of course, the Catholic Church abolished capital punishment,
mm-hmm.
And then brought it back in around 1000 or something, arguing that the evil should die so the good can live in peace.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't necessarily die, but I like being put in a mass mega jail. It seems extreme and awful, but I mean, look what he's done. As you say, you could go on holiday there and have it'd be great. I'm sure it'd be safe. It's as safe as Greece.
Mm-hmm.
He's got it from being the most dangerous country on earth, as safe as Greece,
mm-hmm.
by all kinds of clever political chicanery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I do like that idea. That's no. I would like to go to El Salvador just for that reason.
Mm.
But that's what we need to do. But going back to the Civil War, there is this idea that humans are, that basically pack animals have to have a bloody big fight every four generations or so. It's very bad for their society.
Mm-hmm.
Should we not therefore get it over with?
I don't know. I mean, maybe as a woman, I'm not the person to ask in some ways. I think women are probably constitutively programmed to look for non-violent solutions, and this can go horribly wrong too. But this is the agreeability point. It's the mediation point. It's the, trying to smooth over social disharmony. Right.
Yeah. Sorry.
But when that's gone, when that's taken to an extreme or that becomes too dominant, that also ends up in suicidal empathy and these kind of things. Right. What do you call it? I think the Victorians called it telescopic philanthropy, you know, where you start to empathize with abstractions and groups of people abroad and you sort of forget about your immediate family and you must have seen that famous heat graph of like the liberal mind,
yeah.
and the conservative mind, or however we want to put it.
Like Nietzsche summarized it in some piquant way, didn't he? Yeah, that you end up with the criminal. Actually, that's a good point then, going back to the feminization of society. So according to Strauss-Howe, you know that Strauss-Howe book? So they note that essentially every four generations, there is an economic collapse and a massive war. And they put it down to various environmental issues that it goes like this. A researcher that I know from Finland called Jani Miettinen argues that even with like reindeer, across a number of generations, you get fluctuations in certain hormones, and this helps them to avoid predation and things like this, things like oxytocin, testosterone. So you get changes in size, changes in behavior. And he argues that you get this in humans across four generations until you get to a generation that's in charge, that's very high in testosterone, very low in oxytocin, whatever, and then you have a massive war.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if two reasons why we haven't had that war yet, and we should have done, is one is when the economy collapsed in 07, we're just so rich,
mm-hmm.
that we're able to stop the process from falling apart. And perhaps two, as you implied, perhaps the feminization of society.
Yeah, but I think the feminization is downstream of the technologization of society. And I think that war today is also very different from war in the First World War. And I mean, you know, after all, the First World War probably killed undoubtedly some of the best young men of that generation, you know, and we live downstream of that pointless slaughter, if you see what I mean. You know, like the men that volunteered to fight in the First World War would have been, if you like, the best men morally and otherwise. So I don't know, because technology has shifted things so much that A, it seems difficult to imagine war in the Homeric sense or the physical sense, because it's all drones and whatever, weapons and bio warfare and things like that. Do you see what I mean? It's not, you know, it's not like groups of men confronting each other in a field with lances. You know, it's something very different. I mean, personally, I'm opposed to war, but then I would be, you know, because I'm a woman. And I think some of this is up to men. Like there are problems that we can't solve, and nor should we, if you see what I mean.
Nor should women.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is a very unusual view from a feminist. Are you a feminist?
Well, yeah, in the sense of being a second waver and thinking that sexual difference is real and important and meaningful in many situations, if not all. So yes.
So, but then what as a feminist are you fighting for? What is it you want to achieve?
The continued recognition of the differences between men and women and the different needs, therefore, of the sexes.
So how do you think that contemporary society is not meeting the needs?
Well, contemporary is a liberal society presupposes the sort of sexless individual. You know, the consumer individual, work and play have all become very homogenized. Men and women are basically interchangeable in most jobs. Also in, you know, do you remember when the dating apps, which were based on Grindr, which is a gay app, were first brought in and they tried to bring in heterosexual dating apps for the first time? I can't remember, early 2000s maybe. And all of the press were saying, oh, heterosexual women will never go for this. Women need romance, you know, they're not like gay men, you know, it's not about the act, it's not about sex, it's about something else, it's about narrative and so on. And yet, you know, what happened was that women took up these apps and they became more like gay men. Everybody's sexuality is now like that of a gay man, right? It's sort of people are being programmed to be, I don't know how to put it, consumerist, like partial. It's all about a sort of exchange.
Yes. Yeah,
right?
Yes, yes.
You know, but this is apparent.
And it takes, yes, I agree. I was talking to a guy earlier who seems to have basically set up a mass prostitution website. It's like Uber or something, and you just put in the information.
Are you ready for the future of the West?